Yeah, I remember when Diz was in Greece back in 57. He did such a good job, we started sending jazz all over the world.
Believe it or not, jazz was once one of America's secret weapons during the Cold War.
The State Department has discovered jazz. It reaches folks like nothing ever has. Like when they feel that jazzy rhythm, they know we're really with them. That's what we call cultural exchange.
Back in the 50s and 60s, the U.S. government recruited America's top jazz musicians, Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, and Duke Ellington, among others, and sent them to political hotspots around the world. The goal was to win the hearts and minds of the Third World. The jazz ambassadors knew they were pawns in the Cold War, but they had their own reasons for going. You'll find this remarkable story in a book called Satchmo Blows Up the World. Steve Paulson talked with the author, Penny Von Eschen.
I'm sure this is news to lots of jazz fans that jazz once played a part in the Cold War. Why did the State Department ever care about jazz?
Well, U.S. officials in the 1950s saw themselves as in an intense cultural competition with the Soviet Union, and they were competing for the allegiance of the new nations of Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. And jazz became a pet project of the State Department because the United States could claim jazz as a uniquely American art form. And it was also terribly important to officials that jazz was an African-American art form. Officials felt that American race relations was the Achilles heel in their efforts to win the hearts and minds of new nations. So by sending black band leaders and integrated bands, they felt that they would show the world that America was not racist, that it was changing, and they would be able to demonstrate what they saw as democracy in action. The first tour was actually under the auspices of Eisenhower's Emergency Fund. Eisenhower and Dizzy Gillespie, the first jazz ambassador, were a real diplomatic odd couple.
And to put this in perspective, Dizzy Gillespie was this bohemian black man, a jazz revolutionary, a one-time member of the Communist Party, and here he was being sent around the world to represent America.
Absolutely. The very first performance by any American jazz band was when Dizzy Gillespie flew into Abadan, Iran. And from Iran, they went to Pakistan, Turkey. It turned out to be a wildly successful tour. In one case, they played in Athens, and this was at a moment when Greek students had been stoning the U.S. embassy, protesting the U.S. support of the right-wing dictatorship in Greece. And Gillespie came in, and these very same students just went wild over Gillespie, picked him up, carried him on their shoulders, and the local paper headlines ran, "Students drop rocks and roll with Dizzy." Gillespie, in Athens, in Karachi, everywhere in his tour, brought a much more egalitarian sense of democracy and very much asserted his ideas of civil rights. In Karachi, for example, he refused to play until the gates were opened so what he called the ragamuffin children, who could not afford tickets for the concert, were allowed to come in.
So you're saying that the musicians had their own agendas, and those agendas didn't always square with what the State Department wanted them to do.
Absolutely.
Well, the timing of all of this makes the story so fascinating. I mean, we're talking about the mid-50s, the very beginning of the civil rights movement. I mean, this is the time of the Montgomery bus boycott led by the young Martin Luther King Jr. The Supreme Court had just outlawed school desegregation, but it was still a Jim Crow country in the South, and President Eisenhower was very weak on civil rights. And yet you have all these avant-garde jazz musicians traveling around the world on behalf of the United States.
this deep contradiction of the United States promoting jazz ambassadors as representatives of America a full decade before the dismantling of Jim Crow is the profound contradiction that shapes the beginning of the tours. A great example of this is with Louis Armstrong. From the beginning, although the State Department started with Gillespie, they saw Armstrong as their prize ambassador. And in 1957, they were attempting to negotiate a tour for Armstrong to go to the Soviet Union. Then came the Little Rock crisis. And when Eisenhower was very slow to enforce the law in Little Rock and back up court-ordered desegregation, Armstrong publicly stood up and denounced the government, said the government can go to hell given the way they're treating my people, and he refused to go to the Soviet Union for the government. Now, this sent a very panicked State Department scrambling to get him to reconsider. And once Eisenhower changed his mind and did enforce the law in Little Rock, Armstrong applauded him for that and said, fine, well, I may, you know, consider doing something for the government. But he never retracted his criticisms.
And then eventually, Louis Armstrong went to Africa on behalf of the State Department in, what, 1960 and 61?
Louis Armstrong traveled throughout Africa. He was received in many places as a cultural hero, and even for those who had not heard him before, there was a powerful response to his music. When he arrived in Katanga Province, for example, he was greeted with shouts of welcome and people calling out jazz. And this is something that really moved the musicians to arrive in a country and to be greeted by thousands of drummers and dancers. And for musicians who felt marginalized and dishonored in their own country to arrive in places in Africa where music and dance and art that they could identify with was fundamentally important, was a profoundly moving experience.
When they swing to romance, because it's all so good, yes, they see bomb. I'll say to you, like the French people do, mama, it's so good, oh, yes.
Armstrong's tour of Africa, like so many of the other early tours, carefully tracked diplomatic foreign policy crises. And in the case of Armstrong, he did a couple of visits to the Katanga province of the Belgian Congo during the Katanga secession crisis. Armstrong liked to note that a civil war was stopped so both sides could hear him play, which was certainly the case. What he didn't know at the time was that the new Prime Minister, Patrice Lumumba, was being held by Belgian authorities with, we now know, some CIA assistance and held under house arrest as Armstrong played and, in fact, assassinated while Armstrong was still playing on the continent.
Yes,
so these were not just feel-good trips. Oh, let's send some great jazz musicians to various countries around the world. I mean, this was really a very concerted effort to sway public opinion in those countries. So let's send these jazz musicians to hotspots. I mean, countries where there is political turmoil, sometimes even crisis, and maybe these illustrious musicians can make America look good.
What is likely is that they saw jazz musicians as something of tools or pawns in their game or their attempt to influence elites in these countries toward a pro-American position. So they would woo the pro-Western and pro-American people over to our side, which will, in some sense, influence the outcome.
Now, Louis Armstrong later teamed up with Dave Brubeck to comment quite directly on their experience representing the United States abroad, and they even recorded a song called The Real Ambassador. Can you tell us about that song?
Yeah, absolutely. The Real Ambassadors was a jazz musical satire of the State Department tours.
From reports on news gathers be, it was clear to the local press he quelled the riots of far off Greece, restored the place to comparative peace. That's what we call cultural exchange.
Both artists, of course, had done extensive tours. Both artists had been deliberately sent into foreign policy crises. Brubeck had been sent into the Middle East crisis of 1958 and the impending coup in Iraq. Armstrong had toured the continent of Africa in the 1960-61 crisis in the Congo. And one of the lines from the song Cultural Exchange says, "No commodity is quite so strange as this thing called cultural exchange."
Who's the real ambassador? It is evident we represent American society, noted for its etiquette, its manners, and sobriety. We have followed protocol with absolute propriety. We're Yankees to the core. We're the real ambassadors, though we may appear as bars. We are diplomats in our proper hats. Our authority comes habitual, along with all the ritual. The diplomatic corps has been analyzed and criticized by NBC and CBS. Senators and congressmen are so concerned they can't be said. State Department stands and all your coup d'etat has met success and caused this great uproar. Who's the real ambassador?
And in the song, The Real Ambassador itself, first of all, you know, it's sort of a spoof on the frenetic pace of the State Department personnel. And in the midst of this, Armstrong steps in and the whole pace changes and asserts, "I'm the real ambassador." And sort of goes on to say, "Well, I didn't come to replace these State Department people. He's asserting an authority which is higher than the American government."
I'm the real ambassador. It is evident I was sent by government to take your place. All I do is play the blues and meet the people face to face. I'll explain and make it plain. I represent the human race and don't pretend no more. Who's the real ambassador? Certain facts we can ignore. In my humble way, I'm the USA. Though I represent the government don't represent some policies I'm for.
So what do you make of this grand experiment in Cold War cultural politics? Did it accomplish what the State Department wanted?
I think the tours accomplished both less and more than what the State Department wanted. Perhaps they accomplished less because, to the extent that there were officials who thought that the tours would win audiences over, not just to American culture, but to U.S. foreign policy, I don't think there's much evidence that that happened. But in another sense, I think having the country represented by its most creative artist was certainly a very good thing. I think audiences all over the world, from Africa, Asia, to the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, fell in love with the jazz ambassadors, not because they pretended to represent the music of a free country, but because they articulated so clearly through their voices, their horns, and the pianos, their own aspirations for freedom, so that what audiences were identifying with is the musician's struggle for freedom.
Penny Von Eschen is a cultural historian at the University of Michigan. She talked with Steve Paulson about her book, Satchmo Blows Up the World.